This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, 7:46 right now. Before we get into the news on EPF and the Big Mac Index, let me tell you what's coming up on the Breakfast Grill just after the 8 o'clock news bulletin. Ibrahim Sani will be speaking to the Vice President and General Manager for GSK Malaysia and Brunei, Ramil Burden. And of course, the pharmaceutical giant is going gangbusters here in this part of the world, in Asia. So lots to discuss on the grill: patent protection, the pharmaceutical bill, research and development costs, all the like. More on the Breakfast Grill coming up in less than 20 minutes. So stay tuned for that. Well, we've also got, as I mentioned, EPF now starting from August 1st. EPF members can invest in unit trust funds that are fully focused on investing overseas, as long as they are recognised by the fund, by EPF. So currently, members can invest in unit trust funds with no more than 30% foreign exposure, and that is through a 5% allowance in excess of the 30% threshold. That is lots of details here, but basically, you can use some of the money parked under account one to invest in these unit trust funds.
That's right. EPF has been working very hard to up their foreign content, which is right now about a quarter of their entire assets under management, which amounts to about $700 billion US dollars, right? So this is because we are too invested at home. It's called the home country bias. Everything that we have, our salaries, our EPF, our property, our cars, everything, home country. And that raises a problem because a lot of the growth and innovation could be coming from outside of Malaysia. Now, you may argue that investing overseas is more risky and more volatile, but when you invest too much at home, you are actually making the unjustified assumption that Malaysia is best, the home base is best, right?
No, you're right. And conceptually, I agree with you, Jules. But the thing is, and I hate to be a doomsayer this early on a Monday morning, but realistically, there is no place in the world to invest safely today with any kind of realistic return.
Do you want safety?
You know, and where do you find safety?
No, but do you want safety?
Because
if you're saving for 30 years over your career as an EPF member, safety may not necessarily be something that you want. You have a 30-year time frame, a 40-year time frame, 30-year actually, to ride the economic tides and cycles. So this is a long-term game, right? It's not getting in.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. The only thing is, right now, because of central bank and monetary easing over the last 7 years, 8 years, you know, household net worth as a percentage of disposable income is at an all-time high. And the last time it was this high was in 2007, just before the crash. And it's because of asset price inflation due to central bank policy. Now, wherever you invest, whether it's in America, whether it's in Malaysia, whether it's in the UK, you cannot buy safely an asset which will give you a reliable return. Or, you know, worst case, you lose your pants.
You want to invest according to your risk-return preferences. Because as a 25-year-old, being able to invest over the next 30 years, you may actually want that volatility in the hope of getting higher returns. Now, the S&P 500 over the last 5 years have tripled, right? And it's still
flirting. And it's still going, but gangbusters, right? Which is disconcerting. But so when I read the story, the only thing the thing that comes to my mind is the only body of people it benefits is the fund management industry, because it just gives them more products and more inventory to sell.
I agree with that.
But everyone is out there to make a buck, right? If they are making a buck while their interests are being aligned, I think that's fine, because you can't, in your free time, try to manage your own account, right? So you got to give it to someone. You either give it to the EPF or you give it to the fund management industry. But the fund management industry is very expensive. I mean, EPF manages your fund for 0.27%. If you take it out, you're going to pay some sales charge, maybe between 3 and 5%,
and
annual management fee of around 1.5%. But that is quite high.
But don't you think, Jules, that having more choice and more option is better, right, Chuang?
I mean, it is. That's why I agreed conceptually with Julian at the start of this conversation. But other than the cost, which is a huge issue by itself, you can't reliably invest safely anymore, and you get the feeling that
I have a beef with your constant raising of the word safe. We are not looking for safety. We're not necessarily. If you're 50 years old, which you soon will be,
but if you put any money,
you might want safety, right?
But very soon, actually. That's very But if you put any money to work now, the risk of downside is much greater than the benefit upside, because of
if you had said that at the start of 2009, right, you giving that advice with the guy who wants risk would have lost out tripling
but
of the S&P
500. But it's a distorted world and it's very scary.
So why was there a 30% cap in the first place? I mean, what was EPF trying to protect people from their foolishness?
I think in the early days there was a kind of misconception that investing overseas is bad.
Okay.
Right? It's risky and it's bad. But that riskiness is sort of a misconception. I mean, putting your money all in FD, for example, that is extreme safety for you, Trump.
Yeah.
It's not the answer as well.
No,
because
I agree with you.
The FD does not even cover inflation, right? But you know, going back to cost, I think one fallback of this plan is that the ETFs or the exchange-traded funds, which are extremely cheap investment vehicles.
We don't even have a Malaysia ETF in the universe, right? Which
is out of that list of approved funds. So I think EPF can go one step further in trying to develop allowing people to invest into ETFs because they are good. You can still go through the same approval process as you do with fund management funds, but and allow that to ETFs.
Yeah, I think that if the administrators had you know, the interests of the Rakyat and the National Saver more in mind, they will give us, you know, lower costs of entry, lower management costs, you know, access to other reliable assets rather than investing abroad. And if you look at it, you know, the UK, we thought that real estate in the UK was safe, and then look at what happened. Brexit happened.
Yeah.
And then
here we go again with the safety.
Money, they got stuck in, that was invested in real estate funds, they got locked out of redemption.
We can't tell the future. I mean, we either want safety or returns, right? It's that greed and fear thing. We got to choose where we want to take our
risk. It's a trade-off. Yeah. It's a trade-off. Well, the Edge Financial Daily has an exclusive story to say that Bursa Malaysia could adopt an improved government structure and have an independent Bursa regulatory arm. Julian, what's the story with this?
I think SC is finding it too expensive to manage and finance this regulatory process. So it wants to sub some of these functions to Bursa Malaysia. And I think the trick is to establish some kind of governance structure where Bursa does not influence or does not put conflicts into the regulatory process. Because after all, Bursa is a profit-maximizing company, right? What's to stop them from approving the listing of a dodgy company?
Well, but then, you know, will they want to give up that? Because they have the power to do that right now. Maybe overall, the bigger picture is synergistic with some of their regulatory duties. So would they want to give up some of their power to another regulatory body? That's
a big question. Yeah, I think that is something that is still being discussed between SC and Bursa. I think it's a step in the right direction. And at the end of the day, Bursa would be able to be part of that global trend. Singapore is doing it, SGX, Hong Kong Stock Exchange, the New York Stock Exchange. These stock exchanges are part of that regulatory framework.
So to clarify, the SC is not going to relinquish its oversight duties. It's just trying to make Bursa a cleaner entity, separating its regulatory side from its profit side, which is good, right? But at the end of the day, Malaysia, as it is with, I think, Hong Kong as well, we've got several bodies overseeing several, you know, disparate sections of the universe. You've got Bank Negara overseeing banks. You've got the SE overseeing, you know, the entire industry, including derivatives and the bond market. Then you've got Bursa, which is a frontline regulator, and it's embedded deep within the whole structure, and it makes them a bit schizophrenic. So, you know, it is still an overlapping thing, which people are not really clear about.
But other countries, that's the same problem that's being faced in other countries as well, right?
It is. You know, David Webb in Hong Kong has made a big deal out of this, but
we saw that Hong Kong Exchange rejected, maybe they got spurned by Alibaba, right? But they kind of also, in a way, rejected Alibaba as well because they didn't have that dual shareholding rule which caused Alibaba to go to New York. So that shows you that is the kind of independence that can exist within a regulatory framework.
Well, the German finance minister, he says he's trying to tax financial transactions on the global agenda, trying to, after attempts at Europe have stalled. And he says that even if results will only materialize after years, that's fine. So if you look at the plans for a financial transaction tax, it's already failed within the EU nations, but now this could be something that could be on a global basis.
I think they're talking about stock market transactions and speculative trading to tax that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, all the vested interests would, like the banks, right? The big banks of the world would disagree with this kind of tax. But I think it goes some way. It's a clever way to raise money for governments as well as to reduce non-productive speculation.
Well, it's more than clever, right? Because, you know, VAT in Europe, GST in Malaysia, and 157 other countries around the world. You know, the normal people pay taxes, but, you know, the higher-ups, the so-called elites, they don't pay in. Like, for example, if you make, you know, capital appreciations or gains on the stock market, there is no tax on that. And the only
Look at Chuang getting all fired up on this topic.
Yeah, so I'm quite intrigued that Wolfgang Schäuble has mooted this, because clearly, you know, the German finance minister trying to tax his compatriots and compadres in the system.
Even his name sounds scary, like
Schäuble.
Wolfgang.
I will kill you.
I mean, it's a gang of wolves.
I'll get one.
That's no, the fear factor right there. No, scare no, them into
there
submission.
There is no adequate response to Julian when he speaks like that.
Okay, well, let's move on to the Big Mac Index then, which is, as you may have, you may know, it's an informal way of measuring the purchasing power parity between currencies. It's been around for many years now. You just compare the price of a Big Mac in different countries and see how different it is. So in Malaysia, McDonald's fast food items are about 60% cheaper than the US. So this analysts are saying this projects that the ringgit is undervalued by about 60%.
So the average cost of a Big Mac in the United States costs $5 US dollars, and in Malaysia it costs $2. That means that this is really a way that has been devised by The Economist magazine to tell you the undervaluation or the overvaluation of exchange rates. And in formal economic terms, this is called the purchasing power parity. And it's removed from how currency traders would value the currency, which is really based on their whims, right?
Yeah. So, you know, based on very rough sums, that makes the ringgit about 2.44 to the US dollar. And who in this whole entire country wouldn't wish it was at 2.44 to the US dollar?
Yeah, in fact, Malaysia, if you look at the chart from the Economist in magazine, right, Malaysia is right at the bottom, the cheapest, cheaper than South Africa, Indonesia, and India. I think it either has got something to do with the ringgit or it's got something to do with the Big Mac, how cheap the Big Mac is in KL. Well,
so what does an undervalued... I mean, 60% is huge. I think it's a big number for the ringgit to be undervalued. How did it get to that point?
Well, part of it is the preconception or misconception. But some might say that the ringgit is an oil currency. Some would also say that because of the, you know, follies at, you know, that 1 MDB level and the government and all this kind of shenanigans that has caused our ringgit to deteriorate. And then there's, of course, all our fundamentals, which is our high debt situation, government debt, private debt, etc. All those conspire to hit our ringgit in the wrong direction.
Yeah, so the cheap Big Mac is actually a reflection of cheapness. I mean, the labor, the delivery process, the supply chain results in a cheap Big Mac. And that is supposed to theoretically invite investors to come into a country, to invest in a country, because you can eat cheap Big Macs and you can hire cheap workers and you can deliver your goods cheaply, right? But they are not coming in, and the $42 billion dollar ringgit question is, why are they not coming in, right?
42 billion being the operative number.
So do you think Bank Negara is watching the Big Mac Index in, looking at our, and also our Forex reserves as well?
With an eagle eye. But, you know, I would have to respectfully submit to the Economist that the Big Mac Index is a bit antiquated, because nobody goes to McDonald's. Well, I shouldn't say that, because McDonald's will kill me.
I'm a fast food consumer.
The Economist will kill you as well.
But who goes to McDonald's anymore because of the, you know, the nutritional and all kinds of stuff that concerns,
I'm sure,
right?
McDonald's would disagree. There's no unhealthy food. That's just unhealthy eating. Is the comment from the CEO of That's McDonald's. Right. There you go. Car makers are warning once again that the B10 biofuel is unsuitable for their diesel engines, and that if the government actually goes through with the B10 program, then this could risk the manufacturer's warranty being void. So the Malaysian Automotive Association, MAA, says that most car manufacturers are just simply not ready for B10.
Yeah, so it's a tale of two halves, and, you know, it's opposing forces of equal strength here, because the commodity complex collapse has led to a whole stockpile of palm oils, you know, building up in Malaysian and stockpiles, inventories. And we're trying to get rid of it. We can't get rid of it fast enough. So we introduce a biodiesel policy whereby, you know, cars and vehicles get to put 10% of, palm in their tanks. And off we go. At least there's an offtake of biodiesel. The problem is cars in the country with a diesel engine are usually the European makers. And they have built their engines and the specifications to a very, very high degree of refinement. And they say that by introducing 10% biodiesel in their engines, there will be all kinds of repercussions.
Void warranties. Yep,
there would be repercussions on the common rail engines, the high pressure injection engines. There would be accelerated wear and tear. And as a result, it would void the warranties. And who's going to bear the cost of replacing these parts if the government introduces this policy? No one really knows, you see. That's the problem.
I think I have a problem with the fact that the government is effectively engaging in a policy to rig palm oil prices.
That's right.
You're using existing inventory and stocks of palm oil, unused inventory, to go into this policy. And nobody knows, because it is so opaque, how much cost the government has to fund with this and who bears the cost of technology. I think that's why possibly the car companies are making noise as well. It should be more comprehensive as well. For example, palm oil is also a food item. Do you want to create food inflation?
The food versus fuel debate. Yeah. Wait, are you saying that the B10 policy is purely driven by the need to increase use of palm oil? Are there any environmental effects to this? I mean, when you tell me biodiesel, I assume this is healthier for the environment.
Well, no, you are really clearing land to put what are processed trees into your car, right? It's a hugely hugely environmentally taxing process. I mean, what with oil prices having crashed to a very cheap level, and nobody knows where oil prices is going, but they say that it's not going anywhere. So why spend so much money on that technology when you have existing more efficient technologies? And in fact, the policies in the United States and Europe, the bioethanol policies, are now in the process of being reversed.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, just looking at some of the other countries that are using B10, you've got Argentina and Ecuador and Colombia.
Well, the only two big palm producers in the world of any kind of note are the Indonesians and Malaysians. Between both of us, we control about 96% of global production. And Indonesia has moved up to, I think, B15 or maybe even higher than that. But the problem is they don't have the same kind of vehicle technologies or standards that we have in Malaysia. You know, the BMWs, the Mercedeses, the Volvos, and those with, you know, advanced diesel technology would be the loath to allow this level of refined palm in their engines because they just are not built for it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.